Blog Talk Radio.
And we want to say welcome to everybody out there listening at blogtalkradio.com/KThompsonLiveShow. You can hear us every Wednesday live at 8 to 9 p.m., or you can listen to the show's archived as well. Listen to your favorite one. I am the son, normally known as Eric Payne, and you are, here it is.
I'm the mother, known as the mother of Eric Payne and Lisa Payne, et cetera. Okay, welcome everybody to KThompson Live. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right, we are getting, I always need a pillow this today. I have my pillow. Thank you very much. KThompson Live, everyone, 8 to 9 every Wednesday night, and thank you for listening in. Boy, now very comfortable. Okay, you know, I wonder if you've been listening to the debates, you know, the presidential debates. Wow, what excitement there is. There's so many people running as on the Republican side and the Democratic side, and you don't know who's who, and it's really very, very exciting, although it's kind of like nasty, isn't it? And I'm talking about because of the personality, if you will, of, you know, Donald Trump, who has made this really like a farce and a joke at times. He is an entertainer, I'll say that. I don't know how serious he is about, you know, being president, although he says he is. He gets very insulted when people, you know, come up against him and disagree with him just about everything. And there's so many other people who are also, you know, acting like children. And one is our dear governor of the state of New Jersey, Chris Christie. Boy, I'm telling you, he's a real piece of work. You know, the people are blaming Obama, President Obama, for everything. Everything but the good things that have gone on since his, you know, presidency. He has been elected two times. Okay, he's been president for 4 years and another 4 years. So apparently the people of, you know, the country, you know, American people are very satisfied with what he has done and the policies that he has placed and the different topics that he's been dealing with. And it has not been easy. It is rough. I cannot imagine, you know, being involved on that level. Although, you know, we do have, politics in the family. You know, Congressman Donald Payne Jr. is, as you know, Congressman here from New Jersey, out of Newark. And, you know, he and his family are, you know, very much on the ball. And, you know, we have a number of other people, good people who are here in New Jersey that are really very involved in politics and making sure that our government works the way it should be. A lot of times there are things that are wrong, and a lot of times there are a lot of things that are right. We're looking to talk to not only Wayne Gilman calling in very, very soon, but we are also looking to talk to, let's see, who we're going to be talking to. We're going to be talking to...
We're talking to ourselves. That's what we're going to be talking to. We're
going to
talk about what's going on.
Here's
Wayne.
Yeah. Wayne, hi. Kay here.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes, I can.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, you know. Have you been watching the event?
Have you been watching the presidential events? I didn't get a chance to see anything. I've been watching the debates. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I missed, you know, the O.J. Simpson story last night, but I understand part two is tonight. And
yeah,
I've been bombarded
that.
With, yeah, you know, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just think the whole presidential debates have just been crazy at this point. I mean, the outcome is somewhat expected. And we'll see what happens in New Hampshire.
Yeah. It looks like Bernie Sanders is going to be holding out in good stead, I should say, in New Hampshire. I'm not sure, though. Everything is up for grabs when it comes to politics. People can change.
Right.
Cruz does not look trustworthy to me. And he just put out
the story about...
Go ahead.
No,
go
you're
ahead.
Absolutely right. I think there's something wrong with... Cruz, I mean, well, let's put it this way. I shouldn't even cast aspersions. he, to me, is highly conservative, and he doesn't fit the profile of who I would like to see running the White House. As far as Rubio is concerned, you know, he's a little bit more moderate, but just as conservative as Cruz. Trump is Trump, you know. I think we're now seeing maybe the final days of his candidacy, the beginning of the end, maybe. I could be wrong, you know, because I didn't expect him to last this long. And I tell you, I was listening to talk radio a little bit yesterday, and I was so taken back when someone referred to your governor as the Disney World character, Shamu, you know?
And not my governor.
I should say Governor Christie, not your governor.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, he just happens to be in New Jersey, okay? There's still that problem of the George Washington Bridge that he's got to deal with. So that has not been completely settled as far as a lot of people in New Jersey are concerned. So, you know,
even though
politics is the way that we get our government going in our country, you know, for the good of all the people, you know, sometimes we have the wrong people in the right offices. And I really don't trust Governor Chris Christie, really, because I'm seeing an indication that, you know, he loses his temper very quickly. He is nasty. He tells you to sit down and shut up. And then he expects people to vote for him. Okay, so I think I'm hoping that his term in office is short because he is not a nice person. He is not presidential, okay? And this is the greatest country in the world, for God's sake, you know, and those people aren't really respecting the office. Cruz, I don't think he was honest when he said that about Carson. Carson had to go out of town, which I find, you know, very odd anyway, but he told people that he was going out of town back home or something to get something to wear or something to eat or whatever. But anyway, then Cruz said that Carson said that he was going out and leaving the race for the presidency. He did not have those words, but that's what was said. And so therefore, Cruz is, to me, not to be trusted. Rubio has... You know, he has an excellent opportunity, but he needs to stop, you know, knocking Obama. Obama runs circles around everyone, you know. So he can learn from some of these people. I think he may be on the right. You know, I like Wayne. I like Sanders, okay? Older guy, I like Sanders. I like Hillary also, but the point is that the Clintons have been in office, like them a lot. But, you know, she, you know, I want to see, you know, somebody else in there. I'd like to see Sanders
I understand that, but, I mean, the thing is, the only thing that I have a problem with is that I don't think Sanders is realistic with respect to the whole healthcare issue. And I'm at an age and at a point in my life when that is very important. I think that we have the ability to have a system similar to France, England, Canada even, and things like places like that. But I also feel that the insurance companies and big business have a lock on this situation with regard to the system. And Obama, you know, couldn't do anything about it. And, I mean, I hate to say I'm at a point now where I'm nearing Medicare status, so... After a while, it's not going to be as big a burden, but there'll probably be something else down the road. But I just really think that Americans are really getting snowballed with this whole health care reform. I agree with him that I think, and Hillary is also on the same page when it comes to a college education. I really think it's ridiculous that people have to spend the tremendous sums of money that they pay just to send a child to school with no guarantee that there's employment down the road after they've graduated, you know? Have to say that, you know, Hillary knows where the skeletons are buried the last 8 years, you know?
Sure.
And I understand how you feel about Sanders, and I agree. I think the Clintons have had too much FaceTime, but wonder who else is out there to pass the baton to, you know. And I think the congressman last week, Donald Payne Jr., was excellent when he said that Obama's face should be on Mount Rushmore. I mean,
yes, this
is a class act. I don't care what I may sound a little biased, you know, but, you know, the man deserves his props. He really does.
That is so true. That's interesting that you should say that, because what a thought. And I give Donald Payne Jr. credit for saying that. He is very serious about, you know, about politics. His father made a big difference in Congress. He was appointed by President Obama to go to many different countries and open up the doors. And as a matter of fact, with the whole Mandela coming and, oh, you know, so many different things that we had covered, by the way, at WLIV. And
right.
So we were right in the midst of a lot of this. Am I right? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And exciting times, and I wish in many instances we could turn the clock back. But, you know, so much has changed since then. And we're living in a time now where I wonder, I'm not saying that what we did was not earth-shattering and breakthrough opportunities for the time that it occurred. But, you know, we're competing with the social media today. And, you know, it's just so much that's on the table now, and so much is being exposed that I just feel that it's, there's so many things that we have to keep abreast of just to follow a story. You know, I mean, the presidential campaigns for both parties have been interesting, but I'm looking, and again, I'm hoping that I'll get a chance to see part two tonight, the whole O.J. Simpson coverage, and of course, this is not a documentary, it's a made-for-television movie, but, you know, Kay, you were gavel-to-gavel with that coverage back in the day, you and attorney Pamela Hayes. You know, and I didn't get a chance to see part one, as I said, but I wonder how much of that was just fiction, you know, scribbled in with a little sprinkling of the truth. And
When we were on the air, the bullet story of slaying of what's his name? O.J.'s. Oh, James, what's his name?
Johnny Cochran?
Johnny Cochran.
Yeah.
And I can't even think of his name right now. O.J. Simpson. I can't get it out. But, yes, we were on the air. As a matter of fact, I was doing several things with Geraldo prior to coming to LIV, because Geraldo had a talk show on CBS Channel 2. He invited me on to be the person from LIB to talk about the case. And I found it very interesting because I was sitting next to the evil cop, Mark Furman, at the time. So, and that was quite a joke. I also got a chance to interview Johnny Cochran. As you know, he came to the studio, and since I was the one pointed, as a matter of fact, didn't you tell me that I was the one to watch it every night and report on it every day? It was either you or the chairman. Well, she said it was somebody.
The largest share of our programming was during the hours you were on, so it was important that you stayed in lockstep in terms of getting people to comment and the coverage. I mean, of course, those were the salad days. When I stop back and think of how exciting it was just to see that unfold, I just don't remember any time in the course of my career that we have such a captive audience. I mean, short of maybe the Tawana Brawley case
which
the
we involved very heavily in also, because remember that story was on my show by way of Sonny Carson. You know, my friend Sonny Carson, who everyone was afraid of. I like Sonny.
Yeah.
Sonny was all right with me. He was like my protector. And so that case, you know, really you know, people thought that, that he was innocent. I still don't know what happened. I don't think anybody else really knows. Because a lot of the things that, you know, they, it could have been planted. And it was so, anyway, it was such a big thing. And Geraldo, you know, would use me, ask me to come on to fill in, you know, a seat there. Not to fill in, but to be part of the panel. Because I think he knew I would be outspoken. And he, I was a woman. And being one of the few women, excuse me, over at WLIB, other than a few ladies and, you know, what, like Sheila E., few other people, Judy Simmons, Judy Brazil, one of the Carolinas to take care of her mother. And she became ill of herself and eventually passed, but I did stay in touch with her until, you know, she was very, very ill, though. But anyway, there was a good crew there. Gary Bird was there, Bugsy on BLS, and, you know, all your buddies, because you were the news director of WLIB. I mean, those were some days, some hot scores, you have to admit that, boy.
Yeah, and you know, again, when you make the comparison as to what goes on today, I think there's a lot of media that has remained the same, but, you know, the advances with, you know, tweeting and just the Internet's ability to be there right on the spot and people taking, you know, pictures and recording incidents with their cell phones. It just, it's fascinating, you know? But even with all that technology, we still have these instances in which, you know, logic is defied. The shooting by the police officers on Eric Garner in Staten Island. The Ferguson instance, you know, I mean, incident, rather. I mean, there's so many different things that are still occurring today that defy logic, even with all these advances.
That's exactly why it's so important that Black radio maintain a voice. You know, I had Bob Law on, you know, from WWRL on the show a couple times,
right.
And I'm going to be inviting him back. It's so necessary that we have a voice, you know, on the radio to let people know what's going on, because of the fact that there's so many unfair things that happens to the Black community. You know, Jason, you know, do that deed? I don't know, and I don't think anybody else really knows, but other than him. He's still sitting in jail, so, I mean, that's a problem. But the point is, you know, we find that there's so many Black and Latino men and women who are in then huge numbers, you know, incarcerated for crimes that, you know, the white people who commit the same kind of crime, I'm not advocating committing crimes and getting away from it, far be it. But the point is, it's so unjust. You know, there's so many people incarcerated for crimes they did not commit, I mean, for minor things. And because of racism, which is still, you know, loud and alive and well, not well, but it makes me actually angry to think about the racism going on. So, but anyway, with the O.J. Simpson trial, yes, they did that last night. And I stayed up as long as I could until it was over, to the point where they, I think they were getting ready to go to court. And Johnny Cochran, of course, was, you know, representing O.J. Anyway, when Johnny came into the office, the one thing I asked him, I was dying to ask him, because I think it was one of the Suttons told me, I think it was Pepe who told me that I could interview him if he would come. He did. And I asked him a question. I said, did O.J. really do that murder? And Johnny Cochran sat up there and he said, Kay, he said, O.J. told me that he is innocent. He did not do that crime. Okay? I asked him again, and, you know, Simpson said, you know, the same thing, you know? So, and I really respected, you know, the lawyer. But the story, I don't think that story is over yet, really. What do you think, Wayne?
I don't think it's over either. I mean, personally, I never thought, with all of his material wealth and notoriety, that he was capable of doing that. I mean, you could love someone and be driven to the point where you may do some foolish things, but honest to God, I just couldn't see. He knew the consequences of what his life would be like if he were convicted of murder. Now, was he snooping on her? Maybe that might have been the case. The O.J. Simpson, the only thing that works against him is that, and I think it's very apparent now for most people, that when you assess his characteristics, his personal behavior, he's very arrogant, you know? He has been arrogant, mm-hmm. and that has been his downfall. And I think because the families of the victims have wanted so badly to change the script when it came to the civil case, they were just waiting for an opportunity for him to mess up, and he certainly did. He moved out of California, went to Florida, and he was caught up in some act that he should not have been involved in with respect to stealing back his own belongings. I mean, to me, it would have been just as helpful, and I'm certain if Johnny Cochran had been alive and he had been aware of what O.J. was about to do, he would have advised him otherwise. He would have told him it was a setup, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was an arrogance about him, you know, and he had this demeanor that I see, you know, a lot of young black men of our generation, I hate to say this, but they glorify white women like as if there's some sort of trophy that they've acquired. And then once they've reached a certain status, they feel, well, this is it. You know, the very community that set him free, I don't think O.J. really has any nexus to in terms of having a real connection. And this goes back to his childhood. I mean, he grew up in San Francisco, and from what I understand, in abject poverty. I mean, his first wife was a black woman. But, you know, the deal is that once he became successful and he knew how to play that game, it was all over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to go into this whole black-white dynamic. I mean, the deal is that it's a phenomenon that exists. It exists, and I mean,
yeah,
this is no secret, you know.
So talk about it. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, but it's just one of those things, and you know, if anyone wants to check me on it, go right ahead. I mean, the bottom line is that there just seems to be a phenomenon with some people, some men of color, who feel that once they've arrived a certain status, that this is the way that they have to go. I think it's changing to a certain extent, but, you know, I think people of his generation felt that that was the thing to do, you know? And I'm not saying, I mean, that's a whole different conversation. Maybe you may need to have Dr. Grant on just to straighten out our perceptions and beliefs about relationships between black men and white women, but you know, he did things that I think stirred the pot and that he felt that he was immune to any kind of retribution that the families, the victims of the families would have heaped on him. And he was a colossal error in judgment. You know, after he got away with what he did in L.A., right or wrong, I would have kept a low profile. He was toast. He is living on $35,000 a year from the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. That's his pension. He has no other source of income. All those commercials. I guess maybe the movies that he made when he was on top, that might be a residual to his income. But, you know, he's limited. And he was limited at the peak, at the age this occurred. At his, you know, it was at the peak of his of his career. So once his earning power was taken away, I mean, he was smart enough to make all the right investments, but, you know, he was certainly not a Bill Cosby, and I don't mean to make a comparison that way.
You know, but when being in the position that he's in, if he did that crime, and I don't know one way or the other, he certainly deserved the punishment that he got and he's getting. But what do you think about
it?
I mean, did he really do it? I mean, it, you know, the whole story lends to it. But then again, in interviewing different people, you know, on the air, you know, you sort of have doubts about it. Geraldo had doubts about it. I think he might have changed his mind later. And you don't know. But anybody who killed another person, listen, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, he shouldn't be here either, as far as I'm concerned, if in fact he really did that crime. You know, so, but that was
the whole
period at WLIB, I will tell you, and all around the country. Everybody was involved with that story because he was such a beloved football player, I think he was, right?
Yeah, and I will never forget the day of the verdict. I mean, we were, you know, how you could just feel just the electricity in the room, you know, when we ran back. I know you were on the air then during the day, and we delivered the verdict of him being not guilty. I mean, it was an astounding thing. I mean, it amazes me. I don't want to think that he was capable of doing what he did. I don't think he would have gotten a fair trial any other way unless it was in that particular county. And I also think the prosecution really made a lot of mistakes. But I'll tell you, deep down inside, it's arrogance. I mean, there's a behavior modification program just waiting for O.J. Simpson to rehabilitate himself if he's capable of that once he's set free again. Because I think his jail term is nearing
an end. You don't go to jail for arrogance.
I think it's this arrogance that led to him going to jail. He thinks he's above the law. He felt that he still felt that he could walk on water. And the one thing that you, Eric, everyone else understands in this country, that racism is a factor. Regardless of, look what's going on with Bill Cosby now. Look how the judge just turned on a dime and said Cosby's got to sit down in that courthouse in Philadelphia, outside Philadelphia there, and stand trial for something that, you know, 10, 15 years ago was dismissed, you know? I mean, when this government wants you, spare no expense to get you. And as I said, the only difference between Cosby and O.J., whether it's arrogance or not, Cosby was astute and brilliant enough as a business person to acquire what he has. But he had a problem. And again, there are similarities when you stop and think about it, because those two are probably, O.J. is not as old as Bill Cosby, but he's part of that generation, you know, where they felt that they were above, they could walk on water, you know. And, I mean, this is my myopic opinion. You know, I'm certain Eric may have a different spin on this or someone else, but I just really feel it's just tragic what has happened, and I just think arrogance has a lot to do with O.J.'s downfall.
What did the chairman of Inner City Broadcasting feel? What did Percy Sutton feel about the whole thing?
I'm trying to recount, because I know we had conversations about him, and I think he felt that Johnny Cochran was a brilliant attorney. There was no question about that. We lost him way too early. When I look back at that whole Tawana Brawley thing, that array of the legal eagles, you know, Alton Maddox, Vernon Mason, Cochran, all those guys came out of an era in the black community, you know, where they were dealing with some of the worst cases, criminal cases, until they were able to earn their keep in terms of that one case that came along in the Simpson case, it was for Cochran. In Alton Maddox's history as an attorney, it was the Central Park Jogger and Tawana Brawley. It just saddens me that he no longer practices, you know? Dynamic, he was always dynamic in that courtroom. And this is a guy that knows the law backwards and forwards. He can recite things in his sleep.
Talking about the Central Park Jogger case, do you remember those five boys went to jail for, I don't know, how many years? Well, how many years was it?
It seemed more like, it was, I would say 20 some odd years. I was about to say.
And we should not forget that the person who put the full page ad suggesting Wilding, calling the boys Wilding, was one Donald Trump. Okay.
And here it is now. He wants to recount. You know, I mean, it's just. I think we're beginning to see the undoing. I think the Republicans now are breathing a sigh of relief because it's going to either be Rubio, Bush, and I would hate to think Christie. I would like to see Kasich. There's just something very moderate about it, that Ohio governor that, you know, I don't think he gets enough play, but it's unfortunate. Because, you know, when you watch the debate, it's about, it's that childhood ghetto game, the dozen. It's whatever, and Trump is the ringleader, you know.
So I was going to ask you, do you think that he's he seems like he's going to ratchet up his kind of trash talking now that he lost Iowa, Donald Trump, or now that he came in second saying that, you know, Ted Cruz wanted illegally because he's not a citizen.
He's doing that, and he's also got a bone to pick with about the Carson thing, about him not staying in Iowa during the caucus, and there was a perception that Carson had handed the vote to Cruz, which wasn't. I don't recall hearing anything about it, but you know. Last night, as the election coverage ended, Trump was somewhat contrite and accepting of what the final outcome was. He didn't do that in spite of all that went on. But when he got up this morning, all of a sudden now he's asking for a recount. You know, I mean, if anybody should be asking for a recount, it's Bernie Sanders over Hillary. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that was a close race. You know?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Sanders should get it, really.
Right.
The only thing is his age, but he certainly looked, you know, energetic enough to really tackle that position. I like Hillary, but at the same time, I like Bernie Sanders. I like what he has to say. I like his involving people of all races, all people. In other words.
Yeah.
He's got a dose of Black Lives Matter, and Black Lives does matter, and he believes in that. So, but politics has gotten to be really a dirty game, you know, when you get to the point where you're calling people names. That only makes people, you know, annoyed and angry and ready to do you in. So, you know, it's gotten to be a really nasty, nasty kind of situation.
It is very nasty.
The issue with Bernie Sanders, you know, that one of his problems is the making the inroads within the Black community. And that's one of the drawbacks of the coalition that he's trying to put together, an Obama-like coalition. But I'm concerned that we make sure that we have the strongest possible candidate, and a lot of the energy that's going into Bernie doesn't get lost on Hillary if Hillary gets the nomination.
Yeah.
Because the Republicans are seeming, you know, if we just let them. We play our cards right. We can just let them destroy each other, really, and they'll tear each other down enough where they'll look, at least for this next cycle, in disarray as possible, and to and not really be able to challenge Hillary Clinton, our strong Democratic candidate. I also think that Marco Rubio is very strong. He has the potential to almost get elected, possibly. I don't think it's this time. But the showing that he's making now, I think for the next presidential campaign, he could be a very serious contender.
You know, but also, you know, his anti-Obama remarks, you know, annoys me. You know, I mean, he's young yet.
Yeah.
And he could learn from President Obama. But when he comes across as negative toward the president, he's not ready yet, although he's a possibility.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think he's still a little rough around the edges. And, you know, all of them are going to trash talk as much as they can to just make Obama look bad. I mean, the only difference between now and what happened when Obama was running the first go-round was that this country was on the brink of a financial collapse, ruin. I mean, it was a modern day depression, as far as I'm concerned. They keep calling it a recession, but so many people lost their jobs. So many lives were lost in the war in the Middle East, a war that need not be fought or even started, you know. And now we're dealing with all the after effects of that. And these Republicans act like as if what Obama did in the last two terms was meaningless. And I, you know, every time I think about it, I got to bite my tongue from saying what it is that I'd like to say, because I just really feel, you know, again.
What would you like to say, Wayne? What would you like to say?
I don't want to say anything to show that I come from the bowels of Bedford Stuyvesant when it was all black. But I mean, the bottom line is that I just think it's despicable that these people would not look at the achievement. You know, that they would just look at this man and just, you know, give him short shrift. And it's just one of those things. When you compare Obama to Bush, George W., there is no comparison. You know, oratorical skills. Can you imagine if Bush had to debate Obama? You know, I mean,
right.
it just amazes me.
Yeah, coming out of Iowa, I want us to focus on our kind of a discussion on Iowa and this current presidential election. Coming out of Iowa, the tendency for them to all really now turn their attention on each other, Marco Rubio, especially Chris Christie. They said as soon as he hit the ground in New Hampshire, you know, he started in on Marco Rubio. And it's just indicative of really how weak I think their bench is, so to speak, how weak the Republican roster of potential presidential candidates for this election. I know we talk about the president a lot. He's not running for re-election. So looking forward from the Iowa caucuses to New Hampshire, it looks like it's going to be something that's pretty exciting, or just exciting for us as Democrats and everybody else to watch them as they turn into fight each other. You know, I agree with you, Wayne. You know, it kind of gets you when you think about how they disrespected or how they refused to remember how bad the economy was when Obama took
That's
office.
Right. Sure.
It kind of makes your blood, you kind of want to interject and speak up, but I find myself telling myself to bite my tongue, because just to let them infight a little bit longer, you know, as much crazy stuff as they still say in some of these debates and things like that, where they want to always point out what the president is doing and jump on Hillary Clinton, I kind of like, you know, hope that a lot of these commentators and people like that take a step back and just allow them to go at each other a little bit longer, because that's playing exactly into our hands as you know, people who want to see a Democrat or certainly see the progress and all the stuff that Obama has done continue, you know.
And with our governor, you know, he should really be kissing Obama's feet. Obama saved him in the flooding down the shore crisis. He hasn't dealt with that yet. He's calling
their
name. You know, he's devious.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's, you know, the thing with him, you know, he blows in the wind, Christy. And, you know, when I heard Ron Cuby and Curtis Sliwa refer to him as Shamu, I died. I nearly had an accident in the car. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, because, first of all, I mean, no disrespect on people who are obese, but he does look like a whale, a white whale, a white killer whale. And he runs his mouth like, you know, like toilet paper. I mean, all of a sudden now he sees what's going
he's
on annoying. With New Hampshire. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like he knows the focus is on Rubio, so all of a sudden the other candidates ahead of him don't matter. He's trying to make it look like the big fight is between him and Rubio, and his numbers were nowhere near where Rubio's numbers were in Iowa. So, all right, New Hampshire's an eastern state. Maybe he may do a little better here, but I think at the end of the day, it's going to be Rubio and Hillary. I think once this process goes south, you know, and the black states are in a better position to, you know, register their support for whomever, I think that's going to turn the tables, and that's it, you know. But it's been interesting, I'll say that much. You know, I just, I have to credit Donald Trump for that. He's really made it interesting.
Yeah, what will make it more interesting is to see Rubio and Ted Cruz go after each other, because as Marco Rubio rises up and Donald Trump continues to implode, you know, then it could very well come down between Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz as two Hispanics as the potential nominee for the Republican Party. I kind of heard you mention John Kasich a little while ago. He seems like the most reasonable Republican and one who's prepared to govern and understand that, you know, what's required to govern when you have people of different ideologies that have to come together and then move forward after election type of situations. Also, another big disappointment, you know, is obviously the big one is Jeb Bush, how bad he did in Iowa. And they said, in particularly in, I guess, New Hampshire, one of the areas, he spent about $100-some-odd million. And just for the amount of money that his super PACs are spending, it looks, you know, I'm wondering if he'll be dropping out of the race next. We know that Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side dropped out, but I'm wondering, you know, Jeb Bush's showing so far has been embarrassing, I'm sure, for him compared to his father and brother.
I don't even think that Jeb Bush really wanted to run. I really don't.
You know, because I'm beginning to think you're right, Tay. I really feel that way. I think this is about his daddy and his legacy and all that. You know,
I think he wanted to run the first time. He had to wait for his older brother because he was his older brother. I disagree with that. I believe Jeff wanted to be president a long time ago, and because he wasn't the oldest, you know, he had to wait for his brother to run, not to embarrass his brother, because he obviously at that particular time. On paper, to me, looks like a better candidate. And certainly, George was kind of the oldest, but he was the idiot brother. And it was Jeb Bush had kind of the younger, more sharp, had this you know,
right.
sharpened kind of image of being a very sharp, astute politician. But I think that, you know, the family kind of pecking order, you know, George got the slot and messed it up for Jeb, you know, really. Destroyed Jeb's opportunity to run for president. I don't think that anybody would subject themselves to that, unless someone like Newt Gingrich or I wonder if people like Santorum and Huckabee, who are never going to be elected, why they want to run for president. But there's a certain amount of money that these people can move money around creatively, and they can make money, or they can put themselves in a position to make money from the high profile that running for a presidential office brings them. And I would only point to Sarah Palin as a perfect example of that. She didn't even complete her time as governor before she wanted to jump out and really start being in the public eye, or found that was an easier way to make some money. So some people, I think, do that as a way, as some type of like high level hustle.
I agree with you, Eric.
I like Wait a minute. Let's get back to it. What's her name? Sarah Palin. I like her because she's a comedian. I like her. I cannot think of her as a governor of any place. She is a comedian. And who is it? Tina Fey or Anita Fey on Saturday Night Live? Life was absolutely hysterical. So she adds a comic level to this whole thing.
It's
pathetic.
They don't have to really have a campaign because they're able to. I'm here. I know. I'm supposed to be. They find a way. It's kind of a hustle to them. Obviously, like I was saying, Newt Gingrich, people like that run for office and they have raised campaign expenses. Like they were talking about Ben Carson's campaign, where he raised a certain amount of money, and they were looking at all the expenses of the campaign, where they're going. And they were saying that a lot of the expenses for the campaign were going to direct mail companies and consultants and things like that. Well, you know, there's ways that people can use that as a way to make money. You were going to say, Wayne?
No, I happen to agree. It's funny. I think that in Palin's case, it's about fighting for one's credibility. I mean, Katie Couric really put the kibosh on her ability to be an effective vice presidential candidate when McCain was running, and it went downhill after that. I mean, it showed how limited and the fragility of her knowledge about what was going on in the world spoke volumes. She just happened to be a pretty face. So I think when she got to the point where she had suffered enough public scrutiny and embarrassment that she had no choice but to, drop out and regroup, write a book, or write a couple of books, and try to see if she could resurrect herself as some sort of public figure and a commentator. You know, I think the same thing, regrettably, is happening with Jeb Bush. I think Donald Trump has done such a New York-style hatchet job on his character and made him look like as if, he's fledgling, like he's hiding behind his mother's skirt almost, to give the expression. But, Trump bullied him. And, Bush, with all the money that he has in terms of financial support, I don't know, he looks mighty feeble whenever he's addressing the issues. And I guess even more so embarrassing is that, he was a mentor for Rubio, and here's the classic case of the student kicking the teacher's behind, So, I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I guess it will remain to be seen whether Jeb Bush ends up like Sarah Palin. I don't think that history has been written yet.
He's brighter than Palin.
Right. And he was a little bit more serious than she was. In certain places, obviously, it's easier to hold public office. A lot of times public office is like a popularity contest, I guess, in certain parts of the country. You got so many thousand municipalities where people are dog catcher and mayor, same in small towns. And I think that the governorship of Alaska might have been a low-profile kind of governorship. And I don't know how she got elected, but I can imagine she probably got elected for being very popular and had a kind of a superficial kind of program and platform. But in the spotlight of the national spotlight, and to be considered and really – on the next level, certainly on vice president, that's a huge leap from some of these positions where people get elected on national. And the amount of responsibility and work and things that requires is really, you got to be a heady person. It's kind of weeds out the not-too-sharp people from the really astute people, even being in Congress, something like senator. You wonder why Congress gives us people like Michelle Bachmann or Steve King. And, really, it's really easy for some of these people, not easy, but it's surprisingly easy that some of these people can get elected with some of the opinions that they have. And it really enlightens you as just to how intelligent the electorate is in certain locations in the United States. When it takes for example, each congressperson in the United States might represent about 600,000 people. And of that number of people they represent, maybe you have a very small percentage that are actually registered to vote, and even smaller percentage that actually turn out to vote. So that means a very small percentage of people who stay active, stay aware, stay really enthusiastic, those are the ones that are deciding the outcome in a lot of these scenarios. So just like you have someone getting elected here on the East Coast, on the West Coast, or in the Midwest, you can have a Sarah Palin or Jody Ernst, the senator lady from wherever she's from, that had her commercial saying she grew up on a hog farm castrating hogs.
That was
a commercial, for crying out loud.
Right.
So the mentality of some of these people that are getting elected to the highest office in the land, when you wonder really what it takes to get them elected, it's a very small number of people that are staying active. And really, they talk about the Iowa caucuses, for example. I watched on MSNBC as they broke down in a report what it really was. And they were saying that only 16% of registered voters in Iowa take part in the caucus. So that tells you it's not can't be very scientific if only 16% of the overall population that actually votes takes part in it. And secondly,
right,
the way the process is kind of, you know, real basic, you know, for the Democrats, they write a name on a piece of paper, they put it in a slot, you know, they break it down to three. I mean, that's for the Republicans. For the Democrats, you literally have to stand in the area of the room if you support one person or another. So, I mean, it's really kind of a real basic, simplistic system. And they say you have to be in a certain place by 7 p.m. Well, that narrows it down even more, because what if people can't make it there by 7 p.m.?
Exactly. You know,
when people go to vote, they have 8-9 hours to vote. So, you know, it's all about people being enthusiastic. And you know, they say the squeaky wheel gets the oil or whatever. And that's what happens in American politics. And unfortunately, that's how we get some of these really wacky people that end up being in office or end up being in, you know, governor of Alaska like Sarah Palin. I mean, you know, just the when you – every time I think about you were a vice presidential candidate, clearly not ready, clearly not the sharpest person in my personal opinion, but still and yet she didn't have the wherewithal, the mental capacity to realize I should at least finish out my term if I want to be taken seriously in politics. And the fact that she didn't and blamed it on people sweating her or, you know, lawsuits or all this public stuff is just indicative of the type of career path she saw herself following in because of the opportunities afforded to her by her running for vice president of the United States. And that creates, like, a lot of opportunities. Like we said, now this woman is a political commentator. You know, that's big business. Have someone who has a vice presidential candidate and also has somewhat of a following. You know, nowadays people can brand themselves. You can personally brand yourself. So Sarah Palin's wacko brand that's wacky to us is a brand to certain people, very conservative.
Oh, cool.
They call them the evangelicals and religious, kind of that plain-spoken and, for me, not too well-educated, certain demographic, and majority of them seem to be of Caucasian ethnicity. So it's really, you know, people with really specific, very specific kind of fan bases or support bases can really brand themselves to really turn that into and monetize what they have. And she's chosen to do that as opposed to choosing to serve the public. And it's really interesting that they're still willing to give her the credibility that she gets as a decision maker, a thinker in a certain segment of the population. It's really remarkable.
Well, I mean, you can't deny that at the height of her popularity, the first go round, that she was rendered damaged goods by the time the convention and the election was over. I mean, you know, regardless of when you look at John McCain and his demeanor right after that election, he had kicked her to the curb, you know? So if the one person you were supposed to be sharing the spotlight with doesn't think much of you, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to be the odds-on favorite, to win, and then all of a sudden things suddenly turn around and people see how vulnerable you are, that's what did it. You know, I maintain it was all about a pretty face and having somebody who could make Hillary Clinton look old. Because, I mean, not to say that she was going to be the vice presidential candidate, but the speculation for a long time was that they were going to put Hillary was going to be in that number two slot before Biden accepted. You know?
Well, she was that answer. She was supposed to be that answer to the Hillary factor, if not Hillary being
exactly.
Vice president. If not Hillary being
right.
Vice president candidate. Sarah, they were trying to gear, and they seemed like they've been trying to find a female to gear them to fit that mode for on their side, that a woman that has that type of weight and respectability as a Hillary Clinton. And I guess they thought Sarah Palin was going to be it. You know, it's ironic, as I was saying, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, I was talking, you know, kind of Donald Trump is doing the opposite of what Sarah Palin did. If you think about it, he came from being obviously rich, but the reality TV genre, being a personality, then deciding to get into politics and hash that out, where Sarah Palin started in the politics, and then now she's morphed into a reality TV kind of personality type. So it's interesting how the two of them have taken the same path, but just from opposite directions. And the shallowness of that is coming to the forefront. We'll see how the guy responds going forward, but it should be very interesting to see who does battle there and how it all turns out. I look forward to see what happens in New Hampshire with these folks.
Oh, yeah, certainly. It's
going to
be interesting.
Yeah. So, Wayne, we are going to be paying attention to what's going on politically and finding out what tomorrow brings. I'm anxious to hear what Bernie Sanders is going to be doing out there in, Iowa? Not Iowa, New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, right.
The battle continues, you know. So we're going to see.
You want to talk about that book? We've got a couple more minutes.
Yeah, we have a few more minutes. And, you know, I wanted to talk about the book from Glenda Taylor. And Glenda is a good friend of mine. She's an author. She is absolutely brilliant. She has had so many different books out. And
what's the name of that book?
The name of the book is The Jalamuso's Drum. And I talked about this before. And this is an updated version. And she talks about Whoopi Goldberg. And she says that Whoopi Goldberg is one of the most intelligent persons that is in the inner screens and, you know, the television and all that. I'm going to be talking about this, you know, to some extent with Glenda. Glenda's a good friend of mine. She is a philosopher. She is a writer. She has so many different books out. I'm going to be doing this during my book report.
What is this book about, briefly?
The Jalamuso's Drum is about different entertainers who Glenda Taylor thinks is they are storytellers. Yeah, the Jalamuso's but talks highly about Eartha Kitt. You know, when Eartha Kitt, you know, went to Europe and, you know, told her story, but she was a Jalamuso. So
comparing them to Jalamuso.
But I'm going to leave the whole thing for another time because it's a very important book. And I have, you know, talked about that before. She also talks this time, too, about Josephine Baker, you know, who was, you know, very famous in her time. And, you know, really, you know, Josephine Baker was one of the greatest, you know, cotton cloth dancers. And dancers,
right.
You know, went to Europe and also, you know, she became penniless and, you know, really great stories. But this is based on, you know, research that Glenda Taylor has done. So, Glenda, if you're listening in, you know, we're going to be talking to you at length. Right now, it's still the world of politics, and we're getting ready to leave. We have about a minute and 37 seconds. Really?
Yeah.
Really? So we've done, you know, a lot with this discussion. Going to find out what's happening. So, Wayne, we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. I hope, I look forward to it. I hope it doesn't snow between now and then.
It just might. I'll tell you that. You know, so, but there's a lot of snow here. But, you know, and it's still cold. It's not necessarily warm, but it's getting to be nice. Really nice.
Yeah, I just hope it stays like this.
All right. Well, this has been the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I am the son, Eric Payne, and it's been a pleasure. And you are their legendary
mother of Eric Payne.
Hold on, let me give you your outro. Well, you're the last one to speak.
Okay.
Wayne Gilman, thanks for...
Thank you.
Hello, Wayne.
And the legend will really speak now.
All right, there you go. She couldn't wait to get on the mic, boy. I said it. Don't turn the mic away.
Listen, Jonah, next Wednesday, 8 to 9 o'clock. You know, we're for different interviews and different information, a lot that you haven't heard of before. So we're going to be listening to the O.J. Simpson thing a little bit more. You know, we need to talk about Rodney King and what he went through also. You all know that story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening to you next week. Every Wednesday, 8 p.m., 8 to 9 p.m. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.